Busy city life makes it hard to think about and work at integrating our faith with our lives. Welcome to the Cathedral Podcast, produced and hosted by Jenny Ho Huan. Each episode, we want to help you relate core Christian truths to your daily life. Whether it's science, philosophy, cultural trends, or life stories, we bring you authentic and unrehearsed conversations to spark insight and strengthen your faith and your life.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the podcast. And in this episode, I am talking with Mr. Brian Shen. Hi, Mr. Brian Shen.
Hi, Jenny.
Glad that you can be with us. You are a professional counselor and supervisor, as well as an independent lay missionary since 1997. And the reason why Brian is talking to us today is because our subject is on same-sex attraction. And Brian has been working in this area, counseling many people and supporting their families. In particular, Brian does a lot of work with seminarians, not just in Singapore, but also in Malaysia, Philippines, and Thailand. And in fact, Brian, you are proficient in Thai as well.
Yes, it's something I'm very happy to find myself in.
Wonderful. Sawadikap to you.
Sawadikap.
Yeah, and because of the focus of your work, you are well sought by conservative faith communities and institutions to provide educational talks and training, because this is an area that has a lot of misconceptions as well as prejudices. So your work is very important, and we really appreciate you coming to this podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So Brian, in the last 10 years, you have been serving with those who struggle with their sexual identity and experiences, as well as their families. And you have made some really critical observations. I first came across your observations when I read the first edition of your book, The Unaffirmed Core. I understand that now it's in its second edition. I have the book before me. So I thought, as we start off, could you please share with us some of these observations you made?
Just very quickly, when I first began 10 years ago, it was just mostly from seminarians who told me, you know, in great confidentiality, what they're struggling with these feelings that they did not ask for. Mm. So in 2013, I was asked by one of these religious communities to give a talk. And I was actually looking around for something that gives me a framework. And so I initially started with these 8 points from the Center for Gender Wholeness. Mm. So it's written out in my chapter 3, these 8 factors. And these 8 factors have been very helpful to start me off. So let me just quickly read out these 8 factors. Same-sex disaffiliation, which means a person somehow is not having enough affiliations with the same sex, either from the same sex parent or same-sex schoolmates or siblings and all of that. The next one would be gender incongruence, a sense of not feeling that I'm up to what the other people of the same sex are. Okay, so a boy might think, oh, I'm not sporty enough, and a girl might think, you know, I'm not pretty enough, or I'm not clever enough. The third one is unhealthy childhood relationship with the opposite gender. I think that's self-explanatory. The fourth one would be gender concept distortion, and that is the sense that a male and female, man and woman, they are not made for each other, and that happens when parents fight and one side says, you see, all men are like that. All women are horrible. And the child grows up with that, you know, incompatibility sense, okay? And then the next one would be sexual conditioning, in which the environment is just so sexualized, and a child's first sexual experience is from people of the same sex. And this is where psychologists would say, you know, neurons that fire together, wire together. Mm. So that can happen. A sexual abuse, it's a really, really complex and yet tremendously impactful thing to happen. And next will be certain personality traits, which can include perfectionism and certain mental conditions in which the person is thinking too much at the neocortex level. which affects the person's socialization. And the last one is the biological and physical factors, which over time I found out to be really of a, it's a predisposition rather than a predetermination.
Mm, okay.
So that was the initial start. And of course, there's also another one by Dr. Melvin Wong. It's about attachment styles.
Yes.
Attachment styles are formed very young when the child is just, you know, toddler all the way to about 2 years old.
Yes.
That has the greatest effect, but, you know, it can also have other effects. But the attachment styles has a profound effect on how a child is able to socialize or not.
Mm.
And so it has also a great impact. So these was the few things which I started off. And as time went along, I realized that in conservative religious communities, there are three stages of awareness. Okay, so you have stage one, two, three. Maybe if I just speak about what stage two. Stage two is when the child first says, "Oh no, I think I have this. I think I'm attracted to the same sex. I think I'm gay," because, you know, they don't have the vocabulary yet. So that's stage two, in which a child just knows cognitively that I have this, and then begins all the struggles, or maybe, you know, the question, what do I do next? And then stage three is when they find psychosocial acceptance, which means you find a community that says, "Hey, you're fine, you're okay," and everything. But stage one is when it's below the consciousness, and it can be below the consciousness because it hasn't come up yet, or it comes up and it gets pressed down because in such a community that a person is in, it's very, very negative. There's very strong prejudice.
Right.
So
right.
When you have a very, very negative society or with regards to homosexuality, then the person can really psychologically they just cannot accept it, okay?
Understand.
And these are the ones who can even be very homophobic because they cannot accept it, all right?
Mm.
So even though the factors that contribute to same-sex attraction is there, they can outwardly present themselves as heterosexual and as well as very much against homosexuality. So that's stage one. And then there's stage two and there's stage three. And then there's also the transition, which is very crucial. Between stage one and two, it's a tremendous, tremendously tumultuous transition in which the suicide rate jumps 3 to 9 times. So that's also in my book. And then the thing that really drove me to write the book, firstly, of course, is when people say, you know, we just don't have enough people like yourself, you know, please tell us more. And the next thing that really got me to get this going is when I realized that at the core of the person, if the person doesn't feel good enough, that person is unable to be himself or herself in public.
Mm.
And that unaffirmed core is also the one that drives such a person to be so highly talented. But that inability to be himself or herself is also a crucial factor in them being unable to be who they really are, and that also contributes to the sense of I'm not good enough as a boy, as a girl, as a man, as a woman, and that skews their identity. So same-sex attraction or homosexuality is not the problem. It's actually a symptom of other problems.
Well, thank you so much, Brian. Actually, you have said a lot already, one of which is you have debunked that this is an easy choice. It's, you know, sometimes, I mean, choice is very powerful, and we hopefully will revisit that. But sometimes we try to reduce this as, you know, this is just a sinful choice on your part. And that can come across as very unsympathetic and uncaring and very judgmental.
So yes.
What you have helped us see is that a lot of these struggles, firstly, were beneath the surface due to the fact that there are so many contributing factors to the healthy development of a person's sense of self as well as sexual identity. So many things along the way can contribute to some sort of fracture, some sort of undermining of that process, of that developmental process. And at the heart of it, you mentioned that there is an unaffirmed core. I think all of us can identify with that. All of us long to have that affirmation and the acceptance to say, I'm all right. I deserve to be exist on earth. I have a place here. You know, my life is valid, and so on and so forth. You know, and I think that's a very universal existential struggle that everyone has that we can share with one another. So thank you so much for sharing those insights to begin with. Yeah, and you have been giving not just counseling, you have also been training counselors, right? And continually updating yourself with the detailed yes. case studies, professional conferences and trainings, which is what you need to do. And currently you are a board member of the International Federation for Therapeutic and Counseling Choice. So on this professional level, right, what are some other things you have observed when, you know, when you wrote the book and all that, and you have been moving in Asian countries? I do not know whether this broader exposure, even to countries across in different parts of the globe, does it, again, you know, sort of resonate with everything else that you've been discovering, so that you're, so that what I'm trying to say is, this is kind of like a phenomenon that is more human than it is cultural in that sense.
Well, I being a counseling psychologist, I have to also answer this question from that viewpoint, that for every case that we have, it's not just dealing with the person himself or herself. Mm. We are very social beings. And in counseling and in therapy, we have such a thing called systems therapy. Now, what that means is a very technical term. And it means is that the people around each person is very crucial to that person's psycho-emotional health. So how the parents view the person, how the society around, how the community around that person views the person is a very crucial aspect of that person's sense of identity. Hmm. So as part of counseling, as part of therapy, we have to address that aspect of the person also, not just the individual himself. So a lot of my work is also to educate the systems around the person, educate the parents, educate the community, and to remove their misconceptions and to give them the educational as well as the informational tools they have in order to support that person who is struggling. Mm-hmm. I hope you already, and I hope all listeners will already get a sense that not only is having same-sex attraction not a choice, but it is a huge struggle even before realizing that you have same-sex attraction. If you understand the underlying factors, you'll find that it's a huge struggle. Even if the person were to accept himself, well, yes, this is the way I am, this is, and there's nothing I can do, the underlying factors still continue to explain why that person is just so vulnerable to all kinds of external as well as internal interpretations of what he or she is. Mm. And therefore, it is so crucial that the people around are equipped to be able to support the person precisely at the depths of what that person needs.
Right.
So part of my work is really to, one side of it is to educate. The other side of it is to learn from other cultures what happens when we don't do what needs to be done.
Mm.
So what I've learned, and this is a bit ironic, you know, in some of the very liberal cultures, Western cultures, which don't want to go into the depths or even want to consider that there are factors that contribute to same-sex attraction, what they eventually do is they do more damage, of course, without knowing. Why is that? It's because they are unable to support the person in a very deep way. They are unable to really get to the root of why is it people who, despite living in a very LGBT affirming community where everybody affirms them and says, look, you're fine as you are, go ahead and just be yourself. And yet all the problems, and when I say problems, I mean the problems of loneliness, the problems of suicide rates, the problems of intimate partner violence remain high.
Mm.
You know, so it's not about being, they call it minority stress. It's deeper than that. And so it is a lot more about going into the depths. And I think the people, the most important people around, which is the systems, the family members and the community, when they understand, I think that's when the maximum benefit can happen. And so that's the reason why I have this very strong connection with the wider community, not just locally, but also internationally.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that about the systems theory and the need for support. I mean, it links back to the fact that it's really, at the end of the day, it's really about the affirmation, that feedback from a fellow human being that I'm all right. And when you shared that, the thing that really struck me was how in the Christian faith, we have this concept called the spiritual family. Because some of these people may have families that are willing to work with them, but many of them, in fact, were hurt and wounded by their families. And so they can't turn to those systems because those systems are irretrievably broken and are the source of their pain. And so they need another system that can come alongside them and embrace them and support them as they work through their struggles, a struggle that may never, ever go away, perhaps. And so I think the whole wondrous good news that God adopts us as his children and places us, or as in the Psalms, it says he places the lonely in families. I think that's such a powerful truth that the church can hold forth, isn't it?
Yes, Jenny, I think you have brought out an extremely crucial and important role that all religious communities can play. You know, in a Christian way, it is so crucial to be able to be an extended family to those who, through no fault of theirs, don't have a functional or a healthy family unit. And increasingly in this world where there's more business and more preoccupations and the things that are really not the most important things in life.
Mm.
And a lot of children really suffer in a bad way.
Mm.
So, and in fact, even our Bible reflects this great importance between the Old Testament and New Testament. You notice that Jesus' followers are all singles. Okay, even Peter is married and he became a single. But that's not to say that singlehood is important. No, it's actually that shift into becoming the extended family. So, that's why we call each other brother and, my son in the spirit, my daughter in the spirit, my godfather, my godmother. This is really what the New Testament is all about. And that is the importance of the extended family which the church provides.
Mm. Thank you for saying that. Yeah, and your own background is Catholic, and in your tradition, the whole godfather, godmother thing is a lot more established. I know from christening and baptism, you all have that arrangement, but that's not quite typical in the Protestant churches. Something maybe worth us recovering, the whole idea of having a spiritual parent, as it were, certainly, like Paul says in his epistles, not many of us have spiritual fathers, so that is a really great need in our society. Since we are talking about families and that all of that, that lends itself into my next question, really, I want to ask you, is the rising phenomenon of gender confusion in children. That is quite concerning, isn't it? I do not know whether it's just because the press is making a big hullabaloo of it, or from your observation, is it really a growing phenomenon? And how should we respond?
Well, Jenny, when you use the word phenomenon to someone like myself, it's such a loaded question. And let me explain why. Because the study of phenomenology is about, you know, how a person views things. And your question, I will say, okay, from whose point of view, you know, from the person who has, you know, the issue, or from observers of the person who has the issue. So that's one thing. And the next thing is the different age groups. All right. So let me give you an example. Okay. The phenomenology of a child, before going to school or primary school age is very different from someone who is a young adult. All right.
No, definitely. Yes.
Mm. Yeah. So, if you would allow me to just very quickly speak about the different stages, the phenomenon of young children, where the gender identity is not very clear, a boy might say, "Mom, I think I'm a girl," or the girl might say, "Mom, I think I'm a boy." Well, that speaks about attachment styles. Mm. Right, and attachment styles are affected when the primary caregiver in the crucial early stage of a child's life is not there. And that speaks about modern day lifestyle where people are more busy. And even if you have arrangements for putting a child for someone to look after, well, even that somebody is just so busy. Okay. Mm. And so with increasing busyness, increasing preoccupation and inability to sense the child's emotional needs. A child is unable to speak, you can't engage with the child with words. But it doesn't mean that the child does not have emotional needs, okay? But sadly, that explains why we do have quite a number of children, whose emotional needs are not really healthily developed. Right. Now, at its extreme, then you will have gender dysphoria, okay? However, at the very young age, they are not able to tell you, "I have homosexuality." So you don't hear it, okay? So at a very young age, all you hear is, I'm boy, but I don't think, I feel girl. And I'm girl, but I think. So you only hear there's very, very few cases. And then when you go into the teenage years is when the child now is beginning to have this. But what would make a child come out? And that's the environment. So when the environment celebrates being gay, and you go to YouTube, you can even see 5-year-old, say, "Hi, I'm gay." And everybody around says, "Yay," and it's become like a trend, and I think there's a certain amount of agenda to reduce the negativity about being gay or lesbian. Mm. Okay, so I think that also has a role to play. Probably less in conservative religious communities, but in more liberal communities, well that's there. Not forgetting the underlying issues of not providing the child with the natural growing up of playing, and what's increasingly being replaced or comes in is this imposition or expectations that you must succeed, you must do this, you must do that. And frequently, again, sometimes it's not about the person who says it, but it's how the child perceives. So it's both ways. And sometimes the child erroneously think, unless I am perfect, unless I succeed, then I'm not going to be lovable unless I succeed. Mm. So that's another phenomenon. Okay. Right. And you will see that more in certain societies than others.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you stretch that over to the teenage years, and now here comes another thing about high expectations. Now, if the expectations comes true or it's perceived in not a healthy way, there is another thing that arises, and that is bullying. Mm. That is looking down on another person who's not as good as you. Okay, and that is a phenomenon that's also increasing. okay, in our schools, more so in the secondary schools, in the high schools, and it stretches, you know, all the way. And there's so many factors now, as you can imagine, that our society is just not aware, but it's there, that affects a person's sense of identity. Okay, yeah. So yes, I increasingly also have this question: why is there so many of such cases? You know, what's going on? Mm. And I hope I use some insight that yes, there's so many things that's going on that does affect.
Okay, thank you for what you've just said. It's true. You really pointed out how, in a sense, that it delicate the process is of the formation of an individual life. And well, you know, some adults or parents might push back and say, "Hey, last time we don't have all these, but we also grew up okay." But I get that what you're saying is ignorance in the past, and maybe the mercy and grace of God does not absolve us today of our responsibility. We have more science, we have more information, we have more resources, but we also make some choices. And with our cultural habits right now of haste, of efficiency, really a lot is lost. And particularly exercise, when I hear you talk about arranging for childcare for especially very young infants, you know, that's the couple first few years of their life, that's where their attachment happens. And it's very possible that unknowingly parents may be contributing to certain unhealthy emotional states or exacerbating certain emotional states in their young children because they are not aware that at the infant care, the child is not getting personalized attention. The child may be getting interaction with one main gender and things like that. And I think it's important that we are pointing these things out because so many things in our society sometimes just happen and we accept them quite unquestioningly because it appears to work.
Yeah, I think I need to point out something pretty crucial for conservative religious communities, and that is the expectation of you should be a good person, which is very different from you don't have to do anything to be loved, which is very, very different, okay? And I don't mean this in any negative way, but I do want to raise this up to awareness because here's the sad irony. In communities and even in families that strive so hard to be good Christians, good Muslims, good Jews, good, you know, whatever the faith they may have, ironically, this sometimes unspoken expectations that you should grow up to be a good boy, a good girl, impacts them, right? And this is something we need to go back into our very, very basic of how God views us and cherish us, and we don't have to prove ourselves.
And that's this a very, very important point. Yeah, that's a very important point.
Yes, because I have to tell you that I have seen so many parents, as well as the child, who are utterly devastated to find that themselves or their child has got this issue. And, you know, the irony of it all is that they have strived so hard to be that good person that they thought that they should work to be.
Yeah, I can.
So that irony.
I can imagine just a sense of injustice, perhaps, and guilt and sorrow that comes with that kind of discovery. And you're right. Again, you know, I feel like what is very important is, because to some extent in our society, we have to work, we have to so-called perform, right? And it's important to be responsible and to grow and to be able to do stuff. And do well and excel. But again, I feel like it goes back to the really earliest years where there's at least the foundation of that unconditional love. Because, I mean, a baby can't do anything, but a baby can receive unconditional love. And I think if there's a storehouse of that in the life of a child, just the emotional ballast that's already there, I think that's quite foundational. I'm sure you agree with me.
Yes. Thank you for reiterating that important part.
Yeah. You know, and actually, Brian, this area of work is also a personal for you. And I wonder if you mind sharing with us a little bit of your own story.
Yes. So I grew up in the 1960s and 1970s. And, you know, the world in those days in Singapore is just so different, right? You know, my whole world was really just in a small little kampong, you know. And in those days, if you can remember in Singapore, corporal punishment, you know, using the cane and all that is so common, and, you know, everybody is, you know. Well, before I go on, let me just say that using corporal punishment in a way that is just doesn't cause any problem. All right. So in the early days, you know, if you're a naughty boy or a naughty girl and, you know, you get punished, it doesn't cause any problem because psychologically, you know that it's all right. It is when the punishment is not just, that's where it does the most amount of damage. So I would say that anything that goes against the truth. So even though it's not a punishment, it's someone saying, I love you, but doesn't mean it. That also causes tremendous emotional and psychological damage. Okay, so anything that goes against the truth. So I'm the middle child of three boys, and somehow my father just hated me, and I was punished. Yeah, in a very unjust way in so many times. But of course, it's only much, much, much later when I grew up and I get to know a little bit more that I realize that my father himself has got quite a lot of unresolved psychological issues, which I think in a society like Singapore, a lot of these issues are still taboo, are still, with a lot of negativity to deal with this. And that's one of the things my present work, I'm trying to destigmatize. Okay, so yes, all the stigma about this. It is not to anybody's fault that you may have some of these psychological issues that makes you easily triggered to lose your temper, easily triggered to be anxious, and easily triggered in ways that will affect your children. Right? So I was affected in that way. And even though... I did feel, you know, that this boy or this guy is something to look at. In the early days, I never thought about it in a sexual way. You know, I really, even right up until my late teens, I did look at other boys, but it was like, you know, oh, that's really somebody to emulate. You know, it's just so inspiring. So I never felt anything negative about it. And I think it's also because the mass media wasn't sexualized in those days.
Yes.
It was only when I was 27 years old where, without intending, I actually fell in love for somebody. I didn't tell that person. But to me, when I realized that that was how my whole... you know, not just my thinking and my emotions, but my whole body was reacting, you know, and as a Christian and as a Catholic, it was a huge cognitive dissonance that pushed me close to suicide, even though I didn't tell anybody. It was just so negative. You know, when that happened, I couldn't sleep for more than 2 hours. And I couldn't stay awake for more than 2 hours. My whole physiology was so affected. I could not even see a man and a wife or a man and a woman, you know, being very close together, because it just reminded me that I would never be able to have that, because what I have is just so twisted. Right. And this whole sense of I am bad was so overwhelming.
The sense of
I am bad. Okay. Now, it's very deep. It's very, very deep. All right. Now, of course, I didn't know then. It's actually connected with this verbal and violent abuse that I'm always bad, and that's why I deserve to be beaten up. I did not know it is connected to that. All right. But when it came up, it was so strong that I was really, really close to suicide, actually. And yet, you know, because, you know, I was 27 years old and this is a subject you don't talk about and everything, I kept everything to myself. You know, I didn't even know there's such a thing called counselors in those days. And it really, really brought me down to my knees. It took me 16 years of, you know, praying, going for private retreats, and slowly recovering. I think if I had professional help, you know, as a counselor or something, it wouldn't take 16 years, maybe at most 5 years, or from my experience now, it's about 2 to 5 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so that was my experience. And to this day, I find it very, very hard when someone tells me that he's struggling, because I experienced how terrible that struggle is. It's really, really dark. It's, you know, everything just goes out the window, you know, and even your, if I had the five C's in those days, okay. But when this dark time struck, you know, none of the five C's would give me any relief at all.
Wow. 16 years. Such a long time to just work through layers and layers and getting healed bit by bit. So how did at what point, or what were some of the experiences or indicators for you to know that you are actually being healed and that, you know, you're getting a handle on this and you are managing better? What were some of the turn points?
Well, now I'm looking back with a lot of hindsight, okay? Now, it just so happens that I don't like alcohol. I just can't accept the taste. I'm just physiologically very sensitive to cigarette smoke and certain kinds of food. I am very sensitive to chemicals in food and all that. So this 16 years was entirely without vice. Let me say that I think if I had some kind of vice, it would probably be much more than 16 years and maybe forever. Okay. So that's one. Now, secondly, because when this darkness struck, then I came back to the church. Now, what I'm going to just say a few things, right? Before and after. What's the before? You know, the before is that what you call it, the Sunday Catholic, you know, you just go to church on Sunday and you just follow the procedures and everything. And then when I was, you know, a young adult and getting my five C's and getting successful, I don't know why I was counting, but I was counting up to 7 weeks that I never go to church. I don't know why I was counting, you know. But when it struck, when this darkness struck, I had nothing else. I couldn't tell anybody. I had nothing else except to crawl to church. And that was the only time that I began to read the Bible. Before that, you know, if I read the Bible, I will fall asleep in one chapter, you know. And the Bible began to make sense. Shortly after that, it was the Proverbs, you know, because the Proverbs really was guiding me. And clinging on to the morality, good morality, that gives me a sense of worth. Okay, but I must admit that in the beginning stages, this clinging on was so tight that I think some people who are less than perfect, you know, I don't think they want to stand next to me because I was clinging on moral perfection so tightly. But, you know, I ask forgiveness for all these people that, you know, I was clinging on for dear life, you know. And that's how with my sense of who I am slowly began to build up. But let me just say that this is not necessarily the best way, because you're just doing it all alone with nobody to talk to and all of that. I think what's best is if you have someone that you can talk to. It's even better if you have a community that supports you. So things were very slow, you know, and when I finally came to, after the 16 years of stability and all that, and that's when I And of course, the other thing is that's helpful is going into mission work and being a missionary, you know, in the name. It gives you that sense of identity also. So that helps. Again, here we are, we're talking about identity, yeah? And then when I was helping the seminarians and you know, my reputation as a counselor who would listen to cases like this started to build up. And when I was asked to be in the Catholic Archdiocesan team to help people struggling with same-sex attraction, that was when I made a decision. I said to the other people in the team, I cannot remain hidden. People have to know that I have gone through this myself. So when I started to give talks and I told people about my story, and people were not rejecting me. People were you know, not just supporting me as a person, but supporting the work I was doing. That is when the shifts, the significant shifts was happening.
Thank you.
So that's the most important thing.
Also, you know, as a man, I think work is a very core, it's very core to your identity formation as well. So it's important to come out into the light, as scripture says. And now you are, as Henry Nouwen would put it, a wounded healer. And your story gives passion to your work, I think.
If I were to add, and I want to make sure this point is very clear, when you're having support by not being yourself, but by being a persona, and even if this persona is as a good Christian, that doesn't help. Right?
Absolutely.
It is being your real self.
Yeah.
So despite your imperfections, but you are still striving to do your best as a Christian or as a Muslim or as a Jew, as a Buddhist and all that, and you are supported for that, that is the most helpful and significant shift that can help a person.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, in all that we have said, actually, you know, you have already helped us to understand there's this thing called the persona versus the person. And a persona and a person can be very different, especially if the person remains hidden due to fear and due to formative experiences that doesn't allow the person to emerge. So all that you have is really just a persona that can even be propped up, reinforced by your religion, your faith. But that's not the truth, you see. That's not the truth of who you are. That's not the truth of who God made you. That's not the Psalm 139 version of you.
And one of the most sad. One of the most satisfying or fulfilling work of working with conservative religious communities is when I make this very clear that there's a difference between the persona and being who you are. It is the religious communities who are most willing to listen and take action. I don't think any secular society would be it would place that much importance to this difference. So, and I will repeat myself, I thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to speak about this to all of you.
Thank you. Yes. I think we are about the truth. Hence, hopefully, we are open to listen. It's not something that to be guilty about. All of us develop a persona, but I think it's good to bring that persona and who we are and the mess we are in to God, as you say, to a community we can trust, and help each other work out our salvation with fear and trembling. So before we go then, I if someone's listening in right now and maybe it's just a young person and they are struggling, what would you say to them?
Well, I would say to them, firstly, know that you are valued and you are loved even without doing anything. Just as a small side, I frequently tell them to go and visit the children at Josiah's Children's Home, where they look after children with cerebral palsy or muscular dystrophy, children who are entirely and completely dependent on other people.
Mm.
And yet you see these children so happy when you come and visit them. And many people with same-sex attraction, they just cannot imagine themselves being in that position. So I will ask them, why are they able to be happy? And if you are in their position, you can't. And that is because these children are convinced. Now, when I say convinced, I'm talking neurologically. It's not at the thinking level, but it's at the felt level. And it is felt because they experience it again and again and again and again, that they don't have to do anything in order to be loved. That's the most crucial and the most important. And that's what God constantly says in the Bible.
Yeah.
So I would say to them, search for this God who continuously tries to communicate to you this message that you are loved as you are.
Mm. Hallelujah. That is so true. And I love that it's the way you put it, it's at a neurological level. It's so felt, and because it keeps firing, it wires together, and there's a stability to the soul because there's just so much instability in the world. And that's what we need, that stability deep inside us, to be anchored in the Lord.
Yes, and maybe if I will add, don't listen to all these voices of what you should be before you are lovable, before you are accepted. Don't listen to those.
Oh yeah, speaking of voices, there's one more little thing I thought also, which is how the media, you know, commonly portrays the work that you do as conversion therapy. Maybe you can just speak into that a bit, help us understand that.
Yes. You know, knowledge, and this is written out in the second edition of my book, which is coming from epistemology, which is the understanding of knowledge. There are three kinds of knowledge. Okay, so one knowledge is knowledge of perception. That means you know because you perceive. And anybody with homosexuality or same-sex attraction will tell you that I didn't choose this.
Mm.
Okay, and they know this as a fact because that is what is perceived. So that's the first one. Second one is knowledge through acquaintance. That means I know my friend. I know him. I know her, you know, so I know it's not chosen. Or you are in a conservative religious community which says, no, homosexuality is bad. It is not God designed. And so that's a knowledge you just, you know, probably receive it through osmosis, maybe, you know. But there's a third one, and that is knowledge through knowing the operational. So, for example, E equals MC squared. Well, okay, you know, it's you know how it is. The difference between knowing that the sun revolves around the earth or the earth revolves around the sun, whether that's the difference between perception and the operational knowledge. So, unfortunately, when it comes to this issue of homosexuality, the last one, the operational knowledge, is very lacking.
Mm.
Okay. And not only that, I think because of the fear that you're going to force somebody to change their orientation, and therefore, I don't want anybody to try and find the causes of same-sex attraction. That is also quite high. And that's very, very unfortunate. And therefore, with this fear that you might come up with forcing somebody, and by the way, I must also acknowledge that there are communities who, because of their ignorance and forcing somebody to go through what everybody would call quack therapies, those are very harmful. Those are really, really harmful. And on top of that, if you're coming from a large community, says you must do this, you must do that, and when nothing changes, well. It's because you still have bad thoughts. It's because you still are stubborn. That is even more harmful. You add harm to harm, you know. So yes, there is this huge fear of enforced changes. Well, I'm not here to change somebody, and I'll tell you why. Because to try and change a person's sexual orientation is as difficult as trying to change the accent of the language that you speak. Let me repeat that again. to try and change, you know, your orientation is as difficult or as easy, however you want to put it, to change the accent of the language that you speak. If a Japanese, even if you speak English, you still have a Japanese accent. If you're African, you speak English, you still have an African accent or a Thai. Mm. And even if you want to try to change it, I would firstly say, well, you know, don't place so much expectations. Secondly, don't be too hard on yourself if you don't succeed. Thirdly, what's more important is whether you accept yourself as at the core of yourself. That's more important. Mm. So this whole thing about knowing the core, knowing the operational knowledge is very helpful to reduce the person's sense of I'm not good enough, nobody's going to like me. It's that attachment style where it forms so young, you know, so to reduce that effect and most crucially, to reduce the misconception of the people around you.
Mm.
The knowledge is so crucial. All right, so to conflate and put everything under conversion therapy that needs to be banned, I think that in itself is harmful.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for saying that. I think sometimes a lot of these shorthand words, you know, two-word conversion therapy, it makes everything more murky than helpful. And I think it's good as a practice that we don't just use these words and as if these words will explain everything, because it really doesn't. And in fact, you just highlighted to us that what you are trying to do is not conversion therapy. It is, in fact, it is therapeutic, but the goal is really to help the person come to a place of personal acceptance and to grow past, to heal from wounds, to grow past certain things, and to also develop operational knowledge so that they can help themselves. And they can help the people around them to understand them. So I think that's really important. Thank you so much, Brian, for coming to share your valuable experience with us, both your personal as well as your professional experience. You know, friends, it's so important. We all, in a sense, live with some kind of narrative, some kind of life script. And most of it is a little bit broken, very bad grammar, maybe a very poor beginning. But the hope that we have in Jesus Christ is that the ending, the story can turn out very differently. Even if the sins of our fathers are so-called visited down the generations, the word of God tells us that when he saves us and he works in our lives, the blessing of God goes down for thousands of years. So in God, there is great hope. There's hope for us to find a new family, to find a new script, a new narrative, to be able to be empowered, especially if we avail of ourselves of resources like good counselors like Brian, you know, godly mentors, spiritual parents. There's great hope that we can find the person God made us to be and begin to flourish right where we are. So thank you very much,
well
Brian.
thank you very much, Jenny, for inviting me again.
Yes. So everybody, please get hold of his book. It's called The Unaffirmed Call. And if you would like more material also, that I like to recommend this website called Moral Revolution. Plenty of things to read and stories that you can also acquaint yourselves with to continue to grow in your operational knowledge of this subject matter, which is very important, crucial for our times. So once again, God bless you, Brian. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, and God bless you too. All right.
Thank you for listening in. We hope you've been encouraged with some new thoughts on faith and life integration. You can find us on the Cathedral app, iTunes, Spotify, or at cathedral.org.sg/podcast. Be sure to join us again.